Hello and welcome. This is the Fit for Privacy podcast, the podcast for professionals. I'm your host Puneet Bhatia. In this podcast, we talk to influencers so that you get to listen and learn from their experiences and thoughts. Remember, this is not legal advice, and if you need one, please contact a professional with your situation. So let's get started. Hello and welcome. Today in the Fit for Privacy podcast, we have a very special guest. He's the winner of ICO's Excellence in Data Protection Award in 2020. He has been in data protection or information governance for more than 20 years, and he was serving the NHS. And he's been providing DPO services. He's trained thousands of people, and he's a trainer, consultant, and you name it, he does everything in data protection. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Barry Malt. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
So how did you get into privacy? Or if you also want to add something to the introduction I made, I mean, something I missed, please feel free to add.
Yeah, it's very interesting because at the age of 18, I joined the Royal Air Force and trained as a nurse. And obviously you pick up some data protection issues there about what you can share, what you can't share, what you should say and what you shouldn't say. And I continued to be a nurse, registered for nearly 40 years. But what happened was I'd done lots of other things in between as well. And one of the things I did, I worked in Belgium, not far from you, in Herentals with the MOD. When I returned back to the UK, 1990, computers were just becoming the big thing. And I went on a course in the town I was living, and I got on well on the IT course, and they asked me to teach the next course. And so it was really nice. So I taught in a local college. I also got a job as well teaching IT in a local prison. I can assure you I was teaching IT. I was not a prisoner. And from there, I then sort of got to think about data protection. And I moved from where we were living over to Suffolk in England. And I got a job with the local council, again, doing training, mostly IT training, but some other training as well. And in 1998, I was asked if I would teach about the new Data Protection Act. Well, I knew nothing about it. So I said, you have to give me a few days. I'll read up about it.
Right.
I did. And then I went to a department, and it was only for about 15 minutes, just talked about what the Data Protection Act said. And it went down well. And so somebody then said, can you teach the next department and the next department and the next department? And then the council started to offer that out to other other councils as well. But at the time, I was working part-time with the council, but also working part-time doing nursing in two different towns. Then a job came up as for data protection in the hospital where I was working as a nurse. And so I applied for it and got it. So I was working part-time doing nursing, part-time doing data protection, until about 2003, when the job information governance toolkit, which is an assurance framework, came into being. And what happened, they asked me if I'd go full-time. So in 2003, I went full-time doing data protection, but keeping my registration as a nurse, doing some in the evenings and weekends. So that's how I got into it.
Very interesting. I mean, it's fascinating to see people being in privacy industry for 20, 25 years. And sometimes people tend to think it's pretty recent, but it's not so recent. It's everybody needed privacy ever since.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, and it's only the definition of privacy which has changed in the recent world.
Very much, yes.
So how would you describe GDPR in one word? I mean, what rings a bell in terms of a word?
I'm tempted to say interesting.
Interesting.
Well, I think it's, you know, one word, I couldn't do it justice in one word. But I think for me, as a privacy officer, data protection, I think it is, it's been good. I know some people don't like it, and some people have said it isn't well written, but I do like it. And I think for me, it's given me the opportunity to say, for instance, for data sharing, I can look at Article 6 for the legal basis, and I can look at Article 9 to look at my legal basis for sharing health data, Article 9.2H. So it's made things a little bit easier. I think it's given us an opportunity to be able to, if you like, have a something to hang our data sharing on. I think it's been really good.
Okay, interesting. So that's an interesting word. And then what do you love about privacy? Because you've been so many years and you must love must be in love with privacy or passionate about it. So what is it that you love about privacy?
It's interesting because somebody asked me that, made a comment on LinkedIn just, I think, yesterday or the day before. And I said, you know, I do love data protection, privacy. I think it's because as the world has changed. Now, if I can give you a story. 2 years ago, somebody asked me, would I like to go and work for 2 days a week in Jersey in the Channel Islands? And I thought, yes, I would. I go there on holiday. And they said, Barry, send me a CV. Well, I didn't have a CV because I'd worked in the NHS a long time. Mm-hmm. And he said, don't worry about it, Barry. Leave it with me. I thought he was going to go away, talk to the person in Jersey and say, look, I know Barry. He's a nice chap. He knows his stuff. He'll do you a good job. 2 days later, he came back with my CV.
Wow.
Where do you think he got it from?
LinkedIn?
LinkedIn, Google, Facebook. Whoa. You name it, he got it from there. It was a good CV. It had things in I wouldn't have even thought of putting in a CV. Wow. So when we think about privacy, we have lots of information that's already out there. But I think we need to be a little bit more careful about what information we do share. Mm-hmm. You know, we are individual people. We have things about us that we don't or we shouldn't put out in the big world through social media. But the same is true when it comes to NHS, health data. You know, what sort of things can I say can be shared? And, you know, what sort of thing can I say can't be shared? Right. So I think it's really important.
Yeah, and it's the boundaries and it's also the context. Like in this case, you got a benefit out of it and you don't mind. But if a credit card gets stolen and then somebody you get a bill, then of course you're not happy with it or anyone absolutely. Is not happy.
Yeah.
So in your last 20 years of journey, how have you seen privacy evolving? What has changed significantly?
Well, things seem to change all the time. If I only go back to 2012, when in the NHS, we had strategic health authorities and it moved from them to what we've got now, CCGs and clinical support units. And we had to change how we did things because up to that time, you know, SHAs and others, they could have patient data.
Right.
Because they were both commissioners and providers of healthcare. But once it changed in 2012, they just became commissioners. And commissioners don't need patient data. So it became, we had to deal with that. And I would say, and then other things have changed. And I'd say, we deal with those things and we have to make it business as usual. So all the time, so in 2016, we heard about GDPR coming in. We had to start putting things in place and trying to make it business as usual. 2018, it came in. And very soon, we'll have the privacy, e-privacy regulation coming in. And again, we'll have to deal with that and make things business as usual. And my job has always been not only with new legislation, but also with new guidelines from the NHS, from NHS Digital, NHS England, but there are lots of things that come in and we have to deal with those. So change is happening all the time. New governments come in and they have new ways of delivering things. They want to do things differently. And I can imagine in 4 years' time when we have a general election or before, if something happens, there will be other changes.
Yeah, I think change is constant. And if you look back at last 2, 3, maybe 5 months, there has been this coronavirus.
Yes.
And it seems to be changing the way we are working, changing the way we have seen. So have you seen any changes in that context also? And How do you see some of the changes will remain, or will we get back to normal, or will we learn from it and say, let's keep them, some of the changes? How do you see that?
That's really interesting, because if I could say to you, about 8 years ago, I wrote a policy for telemedicine in the hospital I was working, because we thought that that's the way we would go. But actually, it wasn't ever used. We never moved forward with telemedicine. But then in March, when people can't attend hospital or can't attend GP practices, all of a sudden, telemedicine, video conferencing, call it whatever you wish, also became the big thing. And we seem to have moved in 3 months far more than we've moved in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
And I think some of those things that we have done have been really, really good and exciting. And I hope that at the end of COVID-19, whether it be in the summer or the autumn or early next year, we will look at some of those things and say, do you know what? We did some really good things and we must continue with those. I would also want us to look at some of the things we've done in haste and said that really impinges on people's privacy.
Right.
And although we did it for a good reason, we need to review that and roll that back. So I think some things were good. I think some things we might need to review and roll back. But I think we've done some good things. And I would want us to continue to look at that momentum and keep it going.
I think essentially, in a forced change, people have to adopt something like telemedicine or consultations. And it's a good thing. But all the same, what I consistently hear, and that's what you're saying, is the world would not be same. There would be some changes which we will keep. So essentially, maybe for the good, the world would change after Corona.
Yes. So over the past few weeks, and we had a conversation a week or so ago, I've not been well over the past 4 weeks. And I've had to contact my GP, and I've rung my GP, but my appointment hasn't been to go to the GP practice. The GP rang me back. And actually, in some cases, that is good. And I think that saves me. And I always think to myself, with some patients, say patients with arthritis who really struggle to move, to walk, to go out to a car, to get into a car, go on a journey, get out, go to the GP. Actually, the patient experience is far greater enhanced either by this, teleconference. The doctor can see me, I can explain to him, I can say it hurts here.
Yeah.
And I think those things are good. I think patient experience is also a good thing. So I'm talking now about my clinical experience as well as my privacy experience. But I think it's good, and I hope we keep some of those things.
I think it's relevant in both ways, because even about where we were talking about environment, and then we were talking about privacy, we were talking about working from home. And now if you work from home and follow the privacy principles, you're taking care of environment and, like you say, telemedicine.
Yeah.
That's also win-win in all circumstances.
Yes.
Or all situations. So the implementation of GDPR, of course, it's still ongoing for most organizations. And because, I mean, if you get compliant one day, organization changes, and then you need to make new changes. But what has been the biggest challenge that remains in your observation of working with organizations? Because you work with multitude of organizations.
Yes, I do. I think for me, the biggest thing is how engaged are the senior people in organizations. Now, I attended a conference in February just before lockdown, and there was a gentleman speaking there. He was a clinician, he was a doctor, but he also is very, very good on IT. And he spoke about digital maturity. Mm-hmm. We have lots of IT systems. You go to any hospital, and they can have up to 150, 180 different IT systems. Some talk together, some don't. So he talked about the digital maturity being up here.
Yeah.
But he said then the security maturity is low.
Right.
And the gap between the two is where the risk is for my privacy and for my data and for data protection. And he said that we need to close that gap. And it's that gap. So the investment in security maturity needs to match the digital maturity. Right. And I think some organizations have got it. but I think majority don't have it. And I think we are seeing data breaches because the investment isn't there. Maybe they say it hasn't happened to me before.
Yep.
Or maybe say the risk isn't great. But I think when we think about the fines of what potentially could happen, British Airways and Marriott Hotels, the intended fines, they haven't been fined yet. But, you know, maybe if they'd have put more into their IT security, doesn't mean to say it still couldn't happen.
Yeah.
But there are big gaps. And I think there needs to be that closing of the gap between digital and security maturity.
Yeah. And I think this security or cybersecurity is a new phenomena because earlier the systems are legacy systems. They used to be from 70s, 80s, and 90s when they were built for network, and now we are using them for internet.
Yes.
To enable some digital platforms. So some state-of-the-art platforms come on the top of it, and then behind it, still the old machinery. And they were not built by design or by choice for security or privacy or those kind of things, while the top layer is certainly state-of-the-art, and that's a big, big challenge.
Yeah, I think one of the things that maybe some organizations struggle with is, as we're required to do that data protection impact assessment.
Yeah.
And I think they see it just as a tick box exercise.
Right.
And so what happens is, oh, yes, the IG person might do that, or the department manager might do it, or the service manager might do it, or and they do it, and it's then assessed. But I don't think there is sometimes a cost put to that. It is, yes, it's a way of looking at the risk, but what is the cost behind that to mitigate the risk? And I don't sometimes think they take that as serious as they should.
No, and I think one of the reasons for that is most of the DPOs are from law background. They understand the law very well, or the compliance background, then they understand compliance. But since you come in from the IT background and you understand the technology aspect of it, you can pick that up.
I think I don't understand a lot of the IT. I have some knowledge, but I take what you're saying. I think it's because I've worked, if you like, on the front line.
Right.
My job day by day is information governance, data protection, security, privacy. And I look at those things in a very practical. I hesitate to use the word pragmatic because that might sound as if I'm bending the rules and the law. But you know, it has to work. It's no good saying we have patients being transferred from one hospital to another, but we can't share the data. I need to look at a way of being able to do that so that we protect that patient and give good care. So it's a case of how can we do it and do it legally and safely.
Right. I think that's the key phrase which you use. How can we do it? Because most time people in business come in and they're very hesitant. Can we do this? Well, you can do everything. The only thing is, behind it, there is a rational, there's a way of doing it. If you can find out a legitimate basis, if you can put the right security and justify what you're going to do, that's the way.
Yeah, so absolutely. So if a DPIA is done and the risks are identified, you mitigate some of the risk. You may not be able to mitigate all the risks. We know that. But where you can't, what you need to do is put your rationale, your reasoning of why you're going ahead to do something. So document. So when I do my training, I say to people, whatever you're doing, document, 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 document. So if the regulator, the ICO, should come in and say, okay, something's gone wrong, what have you done? Well, here's our DPIA. Here's our record of processing activity. Here's our legal basis. This is what we've done to mitigate. But they've got a good reason. The ICO, I hope and I believe, would say, okay, you've done all that you can do, but you may have missed something.
Right.
Put this in place. So I think there is a good reason for documenting what we do. And I think that is, that's not our get out of jail card.
No.
But I think it's, you know, the ICO wants to see that we have done all that we can to protect that data.
Yeah, I think it's also demonstrating that you've not been negligent, but you evaluated risk, you quantified risks, and you've chosen to take some risks. Maybe you got over the line or below the line. That depends on circumstances, because when there's a breach, it's always easy in the hindsight to say you should have, could have. But again, when there was not a breach, you looked at the risk differently. And but you need to be able to demonstrate it. And you hit the nail on the head by saying, document it, write it down, evidence it, make a trail of it. Because it's not the not binary, it's more the evidencing, more the rational, justifying why you do it. And that's how accountability is demonstrated.
Yes.
And so you, if I understand, you solve this challenge of disparity in IT and business systems by DPIA. And there's another challenge which I had intended to ask you. That's the data deletion, which is very similar to what we are talking.
Mm.
Reason being, some of the systems are legacy. Even the new systems usually were made relational databases and all those things. That means we built systems to interconnect. We built systems to build data, aggregate data, never built systems to remove data. And that now is two-way challenge. One, you're creating more data. That means more risk of a breach. And of course, management and security and everything around it. And second, you're not complying with the law by not doing deletion. And of course, ICO has put forward this put beyond use methodology.
Mm.
But how do you recommend, or what do you recommend to organizations with that challenge?
Oh, it is really a difficult one. Because somebody said to me about a year ago, you see, what we've got in the NHS, we have a records management code of practice from 2016. Now, that records management code of practice gives timescales about how long we can keep data for. So, for instance, for an ordinary health record, say for I've had a bad shoulder, I've been in to see the doctor, he's given me some tablets for it, and I've been discharged. After 8 years, that can be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some other medical conditions, ladies, obs and gynae records need to be kept a lot longer, children's record till their 25th birthday or their 26th birthday if they're seen when they're 17. So there are different timescales. Now, that is a record management code of practice. If we follow that and, you know, it's documented in our policies, then we're doing fine. But that was done when we were mostly paper records. So you can see. So that's it. What we've got now is, you're absolutely right, we have had IT for some time and we've got some legacy records. What we can't do, and the old Data Protection Act and I said that we shouldn't keep records any longer than necessary. And that has been brought over as well, that we don't keep records longer than necessary. The longer we keep them, the greater the risk. Now, I know somebody who said to me just a week or two ago, they've got some records that go back 25 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astounded. But one of the issues that we've got with some IT systems is that once they're in a system, they tend to stay in that system.
Right.
So, you know, dare I say, some GP systems that we've got in this country. My question would be, when do they delete those records?
Never.
And yeah, absolutely. And I have yet to find it. We are in the process of updating the records management code of practice. One thing I'm hoping that the NHS does is address that issue of records that are kept in IT systems that are their main IT systems. Some of the legacy ones may well have to go.
Yeah.
But we have another issue as well, because we want to keep some data for research purposes. And some of the legacy data we have may well be good data that we could use.
Yeah.
But how can we use that? Does GDPR say we can use it? Is there a legal basis for using it?
Mm-hmm.
Or does there need to be an amendment to the law? We need to still work through some of those things.
Yeah, and I think on this topic, there needs to be more guidance. Probably ICO has issued guidance, and if we follow that put beyond use, at least you can keep the data, but put more restrictive accesses and so on, and limit access to certain amount of data for everybody, those kind of things. But there needs to be more Europe-wide guidance or EDPB guidance on that, probably.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah. Another challenging topic is, we have a lot of small businesses, and now they're receiving some ICO letters saying, you are a company, we believe you're processing personal data. And then they call ICO. And ICO tells them, you should register. And the mistake they make is, typically you have to register yourself as an entity processing personal data, but there's a column called DPO, and typically, what I have seen at least, I mean, I'd like to have your experience as well, the CEO or the managing director unknowingly puts his or her name saying, yes, it's me, because they confuse it with a person who's responsible in the company versus responsible for personal data. And those two, in my mind, are very different things. You can register yourself as a contact, but not as a DPO, because the moment you do that, you are, I think, increasing the risk, because then you are expected to be compliant. And I've had this with many of the clients, and I keep telling them, register as a contact, not as a DPO. Have you seen that first? And what's your view on that?
Oh, I have seen that. And again, an illustration. Just over 2 years ago, just as GDPR came in, I went to an exhibition. I can't remember if it was the National Exhibition Centre in Birmingham or was the Olympia in London. Mm-hmm. And there was a stand there. It was called Outsourced DPO. And I hid my NHS badge and I went to speak to the gentleman at the store. Mm-hmm. And I said, tell me about this DPO outsourcing. And he explained about the DPO in GDPR terms very, very well, not a problem. And then I said, so who do you outsource to? He says, oh, everybody. I said, such as who? And he said, finance, retail, health. I said, oh, health is interesting. I said, you know, such as who? He said, oh, hospitals, GPs. So I said to him, so what's your experience in health? He said, well, I don't have any. I said, so what is your experience? He says, I'm an engineer.
Wow.
And he'd set his company up just 3 months beforehand. Now, that worries me.
Yes.
And you will know, because you live in Belgium, there's just been a case in Belgium.
Right.
Where somebody was the DPO. It's not about qualifications. Not for me anyway. And I don't think for the ICO or for the European Data Protection Board, it's about qualifications. It's about experience. It's about skills. It's about knowledge. And when we look at what GDPR says the role of the DPO is, I think it's very, very clear. And so when you say, and it's been my experience that, yeah, the CEO or even the company secretary has taken on that role as the DPO.
Yeah.
Now, there are certainly in public authorities, NHS, local councils and so on, that have to have a DPO. There are some that don't need a DPO. Now, for instance, I'm the DPO for some hospices here in the UK. They don't particularly need a DPO. But because they're a hospice and don't have anybody full-time doing IG for them, they have said, we will employ an outsourced DPO.
Yeah.
GP practices, for instance, they process huge amounts of data. They need a DPO. Their practice managers are not IG data protection people. So they outsource to a DPO. So I'm the DPO for 58 GP practices.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're doing the right thing. But I think in some cases, you're absolutely right. When they give it to somebody who doesn't know, doesn't have the knowledge of the law and so on, I think they're leaving themselves open, as the Belgium regulator has recently done and said, it's not appropriate.
No. And I think it's also, one is the qualification aspect. Second is, if you are the managing director and you're announcing yourself as the DPO, you're also in the conflict of interest.
Absolutely.
The DPO has to be more an advisory who has no interest in making things in a specific way and has to be more, independent.
Independent and making those independent. Now, there is in the NHS, so the head of IG, the IG lead in some hospitals may also be the DPO. But I hope in those circumstances, they are strong enough to be able to stand up, if you like, to their seniors and say, if sometimes yes, but sometimes no.
Right.
And it's their job to advise, and it's their job to give that advice about the risks that are involved in processing data.
Yeah, and I think continuing with that theme, there's also confusion in the market around the registered DPO versus the DPO. Sometimes people confuse it, saying do I need a DPO? Maybe you don't need a DPO, but you need a privacy consultant whom you can consult every now and then.
Yeah.
And he or she knows the context of your company. Nowadays, the new term that I hear is fractional privacy officer or privacy consultant. So basically somebody who's there, who knows privacy, he's an expert. He can be a DPO, but since you don't need a DPO, he's there to advise you, help you on privacy matters when you need it. And some of the, say, boutique consultancy firms who want to, like you mentioned, the example of an engineer setting up a privacy outsourcing, they position that as something like a DPO. But that's not a DPO. That's a privacy consultancy. You're providing consultancy when they need, how they need.
Yeah.
And you are not going to be registered with the regulator.
Yeah.
Or should not be.
Yeah, I and I've come across that. I've given advice to some people, an organization that realized that they needed some advice. They hadn't done their record of processing activity. They know they had to do something, but weren't sure what they had to do. And, you know, I've given advice like that. But sometimes they don't need a DPO, but they need somebody. And in my role, because I'm known and sometimes I'm the go-to person. I have had a phone call today from somebody just asking me for some advice. I am happy to do that. You know, but I did say to them, I can give advice, but you're still going to have to make that decision.
Yeah. That's the key. Sometimes people expect ready to eat ideas.
I know.
Give me yes or no, but it's not for us to say yes or no. It's for us to say, if you do this, then this, and if not, then that.
I run a East of England IG forum. Mm-hmm. It has everybody from NHS, even from private health, who come along to this. It's part of a email network as well. And what we say is, it's sharing best practice.
Right.
And we share ideas with each other. We don't reinvent the wheel. So if you said to me, Barry, have you got a records retention policy? You know, I'd share with one with you. Somebody else might share with one with you. But it's up to you to pick the best from that so that, you know, it's still your decision.
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the key things with that is it requires a change in culture, change in the way the organization looks at privacy. Mm. Because if you say privacy is just a compliance, let me put it on the top of whatever I'm doing and get it validated, then it doesn't work. So how do you help, or what do you recommend to companies to this enable this culture change?
Oh, it's a difficult one, because I think going back to what we said earlier on, you know, it's that gap between, you know, data maturity and security maturity,
right?
And the risk is in between, and it's how do you get the board engaged and to see that something needs to be done, because they will turn around and say, well, we've never been hit before.
Yeah.
It's not a problem for us. But they have to comply with the law. And GDPR said they need a DPO, they need to do record of processing, they need to do DPIAs. Now, it's interesting because some of those things are not new.
No.
We've had privacy impact assessments many, many years.
Yeah.
We've had a requirement, if you like, to have the record of our processing. You know, what are we doing? Who are we sharing information with? But there's now, it's mandated. I'm going to put it that way. It's mandated through GDPR, and getting that message across to senior people in an organization, it is a cultural change.
Yeah.
Because maybe in the past they haven't done it, but now there's a greater onus on them to make sure they do that compliance.
Right. I think the tone from the top and awareness amongst all staff, that's where it goes. But it starts with the tone from the top.
It does. And I think one of the interesting things that is training. I think sometimes senior people will send their junior staff for training. And I have seen it in some cases, the CEO has been. So I do training for Caldecott Guardians, for CSIROs. And when I do for the CSIRO, Senior Information Risk Owner, and I've seen the senior Information Risk Owner attend, but with their CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absolutely great, because they then understand what the risks are. So we go through DPIAs, record of processing, we go through privacy and everything else, and hopefully they will go away understanding, because the CEO may stay, mm-hmm. but the senior information risk owner may change. But right. they have an idea, and hopefully that will change the culture in some organizations.
Yeah, and I think on one hand, we have the culture change for the large corporates, and there the tone from the top starts. But then there are one person, two person, or sometimes let's say less than 10 people, businesses, mm-hmm. who certainly don't need a DPO. Of course, the GP business yeah. is slightly different. But and then they are going so fast because, okay, for them, it's accounting, website,
yeah.
Marketing tool, and a client and an email management system. And then, boom, they go without yeah. understanding anything on the privacy aspect and so on. So what advice would you give them? Because I remember last time when we spoke, you were saying you don't have a website. And that was also an interesting story. So if you can link the two and help me, what advice should we give to people who are small companies, less than 10 people, setting it up? How do they okay. go about it?
Okay, there are some things that they need to do. I think they need to be, first of all, aware of GDPR and Data Protection 18. Mm-hmm. Absolutely essential that they're aware of their own responsibilities. But I think also then they put those things in place, but they also need to have their privacy notice in place.
Right.
Now, it's interesting, whenever I have an organization who contacts me, and where I live here in Suffolk, I've just become part of the Best of Sudbury. And each Tuesday morning, we have a catch up for an hour like this with about 15, 20 companies. And I said to them, I will do an hour and a half data protection, GDPR seminar for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, that's great. And one or two of them said, oh, only small companies, little retail companies, little IT mm-hmm. companies, driving companies, driving lessons. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, we are compliant.
Yeah.
And so what I do is I go and look at their website
yeah.
and I have a check of how many cookies. And one of the companies had loads and loads of cookies, not only first cookies, but third party cookies, which means if I go to their website, they're sharing my data
right.
with Google, Facebook and everybody else. I then go look at their privacy notice. Oh, my goodness. Some of their privacy notices are just 3 or 4 paragraphs.
Yep.
I want them to tell me why they collect my information, who has access to it, who it's shared with, how long they're keeping it for. And it's interesting because one or two of them, it still says the Data Protection Act 1998, 2 years
yep.
after DPA 2018. So I'm a little bit disappointed. So yep. my advice to them is get the basics in place.
Right.
You know, I don't think they are going to be the big targets for the ICO. I don't think they could be big targets for hackers. Doesn't mean to say they won't be, but, you know, I think they need to get the basics in place and then continually work, because GDPR, Data Protection 18 compliance isn't like a one-time stop, done it. It's almost like an MOT. Yes, you can say, I've done a lot of work this year, but you're going to have to review it again and again. So 6 months, 12 months time, continually review where you're at with your compliance.
I think MOT is a good example. Normally, I compare it with the audit example or the accountant example.
Yeah.
Saying you submit your tax returns or your accounting reports every 3 months.
Yeah.
So make it a practice along with it to every 3 months saying, have we launched a new product? Are we launching a new product? Are we collecting new data? Are we going to do something new? But MOT is also a very good example because it's annual and it's a mandatory thing. And that's the thing I think in the Indian privacy law, they are thinking about putting in an annual audit report. But if they do it, it'll be very heavy because they say annual audit report by an independent company. And I don't know what does independent mean. Mm. It's the internal audit department independent enough or not? So it'll be interesting.
Interesting though, Puneet, because what we have in the NHS and in healthcare, anybody that is monitored by the Care Quality Commission has to do what we call the Data Security and Protection Toolkit. And that is an annual assessment. It's a self-assessment, but it's an assessment that all organizations have to do and make a submission on the 31st of March. It's been extended this year because just as people were about to submit people went on to lockdown. So it's been extended till the end of September. But that is something they have to do each year, and they have to register their DPO, their CSIRO, their Caldecott Guardian with that. So there is an appliance tool. It gives me assurance. So if I was, if you were another medical organization, I would look at not only your website, your privacy notice, I would look to see if you've done the DSPT and see if you have submitted regularly. It gives me some assurance that you've got policies, procedures in place that gives me the assurance that you're handling data safely.
Yeah. And I think talking about the review of privacy notices and so on, there's an interesting story. A few months back, I was looking at the websites of some marketing and advertising companies, and I looked at maybe 100 companies. About five of them had the same privacy notice, exactly same, except for the, what do you say, the name of the controller and the contact. And what does it mean? They took it from some consulting firm and used it as is. The second was about 30 companies or 35 companies did not have any privacy notice. So how can I expect a website which is marketing and advertising and having cookies and having everything, not having a privacy notice? That was amazing.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think I don't have a website, so I don't have to do a privacy notice because most of my work is contracted. People contact me and ask me this, not today, but last week I was asked to put in a bid for some work. I only want to work part time. So I don't need to go out market for work. So not having a website means I don't have to have a privacy notice because I don't hold any data.
Right.
The other organizations hold the data. I just turn up, deliver the training, and so on. I am registered with the regulator, with the ICO, because I do receive some emails with sensitive data on and so on. And I have to then talk to maybe patients, maybe talk to organizations about sensitive data that they hold. So, but I don't have a website, so I get out of that one.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Don't need a privacy notice because I don't have a website.
Somebody's now going to come back and say, oh, yes, you do.
Okay. And privacy is a profession for us. And we make a living out of it, as you rightly said. But it seems boring for small businesses and also other people. Do you have any ideas on how do we make it interesting, exciting for people? I mean, of course, exciting would be challenging, but at least get them to pay attention. Let's put it like that.
Oh, yeah. So but how long have we been saying death by PowerPoint?
Death by PowerPoint, yes.
Death by PowerPoint. We've been saying that for 20 years. Right. And yet you go to a conference and somebody's presenting, it'll be a PowerPoint presentation.
Yes.
Now, I... 3 years ago, I decided, no, some of the organizations I work for, they say that people attending want a PowerPoint presentation so they can have a copy of it to take it away to refer to later. My challenge is, how often have you ever referred back to a presentation? Very, very rarely.
You sometimes think, okay, Barry was there and let me find out what was the name, and then you look into the back and that's it.
But the main principles, you either retain them or you write it on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So 3 years ago, I said, you know what, I'm not doing this. I was asked to speak at a conference. So you may not know, and forgive me if you do, but on the television here, we used to have a program called Smith & Jones, and they had what they called talking heads. And it was just what we're doing now. It was talking about everyday things, whether it was about shopping, whether it was about overseas brides. I remember one being about whatever it might be. And they just don't. So what's all that about then? Right. So I went to a conference with a friend of mine, Andrew, and we just did. And we called it the pub chat. And we just sat on two stools and we talked about GDPR, data protection, privacy and so on. And people said, do you know what? I learned more from that than I did from PowerPoint presentations. Now, I think also it comes down to personality of how you present. So I mentioned about your regulator in Belgium, about the DPO, the one in Lisbon about access to IT systems in a hospital. I use lots of illustrations like that. I also find lots of case studies to give out to those that attend and say, okay, here's a case study. I'll give you 10 minutes. What are you going to do?
Exactly.
But I talk about it. I do love it. And yeah. I hope that comes across when I'm talking to people, my passion, my enthusiasm.
Right.
So much so, just one other thing that so much so, I want people to come in and enjoy
right.
privacy, data protection. So I've initiated apprenticeships. Now, I know we have lots of apprenticeships here in the UK. I don't know if they have apprenticeships in Belgium. But I've sort of instigated an apprenticeship for people coming into, new starters into data protection, because I want people to see it as a career. Mm-hmm. I want them to see it as it's something they can go from a new entrant, IG lead, IG, mm-hmm. head of IG, all the way up to becoming a DPO, which
right.
hold a good salary. So, but it comes with experience. So, you know, I want people to see that, and I'm excited about it.
Oh, that's very exciting, because a lot of young law students, they are essentially coming in, and sometimes people who want to switch careers, they say, oh, I want to be a DPO. But it's not like a switch overnight. It's a journey that you have to go through. You get some knowledge, get some certification, but then you start doing some stuff. And over the years, you will maybe become a DPO, but or there are many other alternative careers which are possible.
So on LinkedIn, I'm, I don't know, I forget what it's called now, but people who want some advice about careers, I get some of those links of some people who want to come into privacy, want to come into data protection, cybersecurity. They're doing a law degree, but want to go. And I would want to encourage that. There's nothing wrong right. with having a law degree. But sometimes they go off and they do commercial law, they do
right.
Real estate or whatever. But, you know, I want to encourage them to, yeah, come into the NHS, come into health, come into finance, retail, and look at data protection. I think it really is a good sector to be in.
Yeah. So I think it's been a good chat. And in essence of time, what would be one final message that you would like to pass to the audiences? I know there have been a lot of final messages and advice that we've shared, but one final key message for people.
So 12 months ago, the ICO said, going forward, she would be looking at DPOs embedded in organizations, and that what we now call the seventh principle, accountability.
Right.
And I would say to people, you know, if you need a DPO, make sure the DPO is there and it's embedded. But accountability. Every organization is accountable. And whether it's the CEO, whether it's the DPO, and whatever, we're all accountable for how we handle that data, for data protection, for privacy reasons and whatever. Make sure your accountability is there, it's recorded, and you can answer any questions that you might be asked by the regulator.
Perfect. That's very well said. And if somebody wants to get in touch with you, now that you don't have a website, and we know that, how should people get in touch with Barry if they want to?
I think there's only one Barry Malt on LinkedIn. There might be two. There's a man who sells houses in Manchester. I'm not him.
Okay.
But if I'm on LinkedIn, I'm
sure.
I comment or like things on a daily basis on LinkedIn. They can certainly get me there. But my email address is quite simple. It's bjm@igprivacy.co.uk.
Great. So thanks, Barry, for being with us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure having you.
It's been really good to be with you. And I, as I said, I know you're in Belgium, and I know the town you live in. And maybe when we visit, we'll have coffee.
Absolutely.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you like this effort. Please do click like, comment, and share. It is okay if you did not like it. Please still do make a comment and share with us what we can improve. If you have suggestions, ideas for guests, or you want to have your question answered, please email me. My email is info@punitbhatia.com. You can also share this with others, and if you do so while tagging me in, I will personally thank and acknowledge your contribution in coming episodes. thanks once more and look forward to seeing you back. Till then, stay safe, stay blessed, and stay happy.